Okay, we are on to our final session. The session is on model risk management, a practitioner's perspective. To present this session, we have Simon Greenberg. Simon has over 20 years of banking experience in model-related, technical, and management roles. Simon is a fellow of the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries and a fellow of the Actuarial Society of South Africa. His studies includes a BSc in Actuarial Science and Mathematical Statistics, a BSc Honours, and a Master's in Mathematical Statistics. He is currently the Risk Type Officer for Model Risk at Absa Group, and he has had multiple other senior roles across his career, including Head of Validation and Head of Model Development. Some of his current work includes the thinking around the management of model risk in AI and machine learning, as well as ESG models. Welcome, Simon.
Do I just stand here? Okay. It's like a new experience for me, so I apologize. I can see everyone is very excited. It's 4:15, and I'm looking forward to my hour and a half here. It's a great topic for the afternoon, absolutely. I'm sure everyone here, being actuaries or part of the profession, kind of understands risk management, because I think if we don't, then the last 25 years of studying have been for nothing. So model risk, in one dimension, is quite a simple thing, right? And most people who sit here, who are here, will have a pretty good idea. There are a few little nuances that perhaps I wanted to chat about, and I promise I'm going to try and be entertaining if I can. All right, can we go on to the next slide, please? All right, perfect. So let's go back to the beginning, right? What is a model? Well, a model is a representation of something. The key there is that it is a simplified representation of something. Ergo, all models to be useful have to be wrong. I think I've put the famous quote there, so third paragraph. And we forget that, right? We think of models sometimes as a perfect thing or an accurate thing, but it's not necessarily such a concept as accuracy of model. I mean, it can be quantified statistically, but what are you really measuring accuracy against? In that, I mean, let's take a scorecard. You've got a scorecard which is built on data. Data is a manifestation of a random event. So then you have built a scorecard or a model or a simplification of the real-world process. And to assess the performance of it, you're comparing it to another manifestation of a random event. So I think it's quite important to remember that there is always that gap between the real thing and the model being a simplification, and that when you make any kind of inferences about model performance, you need to be quite careful, because what you're comparing it to is not a complete set of or a complete picture. You're only comparing it against a sample that you've seen. So what is model risk? Well, the definition is there. Thank you, ChatGPT. That was fun, really useful. It is correct. I've read through it, so that's 100%. It's all good. But model risk refers to the potential adverse consequences resulting from the use of incorrect or flawed models in decision-making processes. I think the important thing, maybe, that I've highlighted here, and I've unhighlighted one, but I'd like to re-highlight it. in bold is, first of all, it's resulting from the use, which might be an obvious thing, right? But for model risk to manifest, the model's actually got to be used. So model risk is not just about the quality of the model. It is very much about models don't exist in isolation. It's how you implement and deploy them, how you use them, what additional controls and mitigation you have in place that determines the overall level of model risk. An example of this would be you're building a brand new machine learning model. It's exceptionally complex, and you're not quite confident in it, but you'd like to deploy it to write new business. But you deploy it through a proof of concept deployment, where you restrict the amount of business you write. For obvious reasons, the model might be rubbish, but the model risk is mitigated because you're not implementing it across the board, or you're implementing it in a controlled environment. Then, look, I've also highlighted incorrect or flawed models, and again, it's quite kind of, I don't necessarily agree with that. So what is an incorrect or flawed model? I mean, every model is incorrect by definition. And then, again, this type of risk arises when models fail to perform as expected or produce inaccurate or misleading results. Again, what do we mean perform as expected? I mean, the way I would think of a model is that it is the best estimate. We know sort of if there's an infinity of possible outcomes, it's never, what the model predicts is never going to align to what you actually see. So all of these things in practice need to be quite carefully defined. I mean, it's easier to say that, you know, it's incorrect, flawed, misused, inaccurate. But those are very much a subjective concept. And to assess it objectively is quite difficult. So that's why model risk is not simple. Then the famous line is all models are wrong, but some are useful. I think the way we sometimes look at it is how wrong is still useful. Yes. And then the presenter before me kind of said, well, risk cannot be eradicated, it can only be mitigated or managed. And then that's exactly true about model risk. Probably more true around model risk than other types of risk. We can go on to the next slide, please. I think for those who are not working in the banking, in the banks, just the extent to which the models are pervasive. In banking, I've just put down some of the types of models that we have, certainly in my employer. And it goes from regulatory capital, impairments, scorecards. Well, I'll let you read through it. I think the point I'm kind of wanted to make, and I'll continue it on next slide, is that in each of those applications, models are used to, let's say, manage or mitigate another type of risk. So when you talk about a scorecard or credit decisioning model, you're using a model to manage credit risk. If you're looking at regulatory capital model, you're potentially using a model to manage your relationship with the regulator. So if we can go on to the next slide, please. So model risk overlaps, underpins, and magnifies the impact of other risks. And it's impossible to isolate it from other risk types. So when we see the risk manifesting, typically it will be recorded or manifest as other risk types. And to isolate, to remove well, what component is a credit issue and what component is the model's issue is virtually impossible. Then, as you saw, the models are pervasive, right? They're applied across the board. So there's a multiplier effect due to model interactions. You see where I'm angling with this, right? To kind of get to the point that the model risk is the most important risk in the bank. But there's a multiplier effect due to models interaction. I mean, it's an example of this would be if you've got a scorecard that then feeds into the regulatory capital model. If the scorecard's got an issue, or your potential scorecard is perfect and the regulatory capital model is perfect, but the data that feeds into the scorecards is suboptimal, you have that magnification effect down the whole chain. And I mean, it's broader than that, right? Because we've got, for example, impairment models that might feed into a pricing, economic capital or impairment models that might feed into forecasting and financial planning. So there's this nested relationship with models of different types, and there's definitely a multiplier effect if something goes wrong. Regulatory and reputational risk. I think that's kind of self-explanatory, but look, the regulator places a lot of focus on models for whatever reason it is. I suppose because it's quite a technical area, and if things go wrong, they can go wrong spectacularly. But also, I suppose, sorry, I lost my train of thoughts. But also because, and I think what concerns them the most is really that the models are used to quantify or to facilitate all these mitigations the regulators put in place, like your capital ratios or your impairment stock, for example. So again, your impairment stock potentially has to do with credit risk, but you use a range of models to actually estimate what is required to sufficiently protect you or sufficiently provide for the risk, credit risk that's inside your portfolio. I think part of the issue that we have is that regulations and guidance, and by guidance I mean something like, for example, FRS 9 standard, are very much principle-based. They're not prescriptive. And that's why we have these long, long meetings with the regulator and BASA to try and figure out how to treat a particular situation. What it also creates, well, first of all, you've got that complexity and effort around kind of translating principle-based regulations into operational procedures, but also it creates non-uniformity across participants. So different banks, capital is a good example, would probably hold different amounts of capital for different customers or different portfolios. In itself, it's not necessarily a problem, because, well, you're allowed, that's the whole kind of concept of competition, where you should be rating a client differently across different. But in practice, when you aggregate that, it creates a discontinuity, for example, between capital ratio. For those of you who know, I think an example of that would be this new distress restructures directive that the PA has been working on. Where part of the reason why it's coming out or why they're working on it is really to make the treatment of distress restructures consistent across the various banks. Ethical and conduct considerations, that's kind of self-explanatory, but because models make decisions and models impact customers, obviously ethical and conduct considerations are quite important. Evolution of technology systems, data. I mean, I think everyone here has heard about AI. I think probably half of the presentations today have been about AI. I'll tell you later what my feelings are about it. But yeah, technology impacts the models. or the model ecosystem within the bank. You can build models easier, you can make them more complex, you can build more of them. Okay. So is it a good thing? Well, possibly, but somehow, you know, managing model risk in an environment where the models proliferate becomes quite difficult. And they proliferate across different dimensions, sort of where they're applied, what they're used for, as well as how complex they are, for example. Complexity often for the sake of complexity. That's kind of my... the reason why I said often for the sake of complexity probably has to do with AI. It is a topical and sexy thing. If you present to the ESCO, the board, you will be asked, you know, what are we doing about AI? Are we losing our competitive advantage? Do we have the policies, the standards? Are we managing it appropriately? And of course, that's probably okay. But then, on the other side, you've got guys going, well, we just want to build AI models in every situation. And that, of course, is problematic. This complexity also kind of obscures. I know you would talk about explainability or interpretability, but the complexity often obscures the relationships that you potentially try to bring out into the light. So, I mean, the reason why you're trying to simplify a complex process is so that you can see what the core relationships are. Complexity of a model obscures them. So you're getting better fit or better prediction at the expense of kind of understanding potential. Dynamic environment strategies, business models. What we've seen is kind of an increase in pace of those. For those of you, I am at EBSA. This is all my personal views. As everyone has kind of said, disclaimed, but I'm sure you've seen the news about the EPSA, the CEO, and the extent to which strategies and environments and competition and competitors change, it's becoming quicker and quicker and quicker, and it affects business models as well, because banks somehow would have to counter the competitors that come into their space through often changes in the business model. And that creates problems for models and model risk. And I suppose the problem there is that of representativeness. So in practice, if you're going to use data to build a model, the data that you've got was created during based on a different strategy of the business. You actually don't have that, right? There's absolutely no point to use that, because you're going to be applying it at a different point in time. I think ESG is something, or climate risk is something that's relevant here, in a sense that the environment is changing. The physical climate risk is evolving. And to use historical data to predict future climate risk events or climate events, one needs to be quite careful with that, because the historical data is not a representation of what will happen in the future necessarily. Pace of change and need to maintain competitive advantage, that kind of is hopefully self-explanatory, but it means models are rebuilt quicker, they're updated quicker, that puts pressure on a structured process for development, validating, deployment of models, also trained resources. Value add versus grudge purchase. I think Cost of change is particularly important in model risk or models for models, and in particular regulatory cost of change. So often the regulators will prioritize the outcomes without necessarily considering the cost. And I mean, something like Basel III is a really good example, where the complexity. I'm not sure if anybody here is involved with that on the Basel III, right? So we are still at the moment waiting for regulators to come back and tell us whether we're going to have to rebuild some of the models. Now, for those of you who haven't had the experience of dealing with the regulator, it normally takes about let's say 6 months for a bank to build a model, and it takes over 12 months for the regulator to approve it. So if we now are talking about rebuilding, let's say, a third of our model, regulatory capital model stock, you know, that's a multi-year project just in itself, as an example. And the cost of that, the cost of, you know, data, resources, and then the cost of the regulator as well is obviously something that becomes quite onerous. What we've seen is, as the complexity of regulations increases, the cost of change within that regulatory space increases as well. And then unavoidable and expensive qualitative inputs. I think in a banking environment, as much as we would talk about automation and and machine learning and AI, we're never able to step away from this qualitative oversight. And I think those resources and that experience is quite expensive. Next slide. So what does it mean for model risk management? Well, it is a strategic capability. If it's not a strategic capability, then you cannot manage model risk holistically. I think model risk, in a way, is, I found it more so than other risk types, is somewhere where governance and process and structure are critical, even if it doesn't always make business sense. So it's the system that you set up that works for you to manage model risk. It's not necessarily the activities that you execute, always. It needs to be risk-based, right? But implication of that, of course, is that we're now talking about some form of risk appetite for model risk, which is quite a difficult thing to kind of even conceptualize, let's say. And that means the bank would need to have tolerance for failure and understanding of limitations of models. Typically, that's not how those engagements go. As soon as something goes wrong with a model, there's a lot of excitement around, well, what did we do wrong with? If you couple it with kind of, yeah, sorry, let's not go down that rabbit hole. So I think the understanding of limitations is very important, but tolerance for failure is a particularly difficult one for me. Again, you cannot avoid, you cannot remove the risk, you can only manage it. And there is a sweet spot in terms of cost-benefit as to where to set that trigger. Then we do have to deal a lot with severe resource constraints. I think the reason why is, obviously, we've got specialized technical skill set that we need to manage model risk properly, but it differs for different types of models. So my experience is in credit models, we do market risk models, we do trading models, we do trading algos that we've started now. We look at operational risk, we look at pricing, we look at financial forecasting. The expertise is not end-to-end, so we have to have a range of different quantitative experts working in this space. There's a big element of general risk management. As I mentioned before, is that interaction between other risk types and model risk, because very often model risk is used to either quantify or create risk on a balance sheet, for example. And the principles of general kind of risk management are really important. So is the non-model risk experience. I think somebody who's only worked with models in the past but has got no credit risk experience might be a relatively decent model developer, but would battle to work as a validation professional, because they would need to challenge both the model and the credit aspects of it. So it's not just a technology or quantitative challenge that needs to come. Regulatory knowledge, really important. I mentioned earlier the cost of change, regulatory change is becoming progressively more complex. Technological expertise. So I think probably 10 years ago or so, we primarily, if you had SAS, you were good. You know, it's all great. But it's no longer sufficient. So that goes hand in hand with the next point around operational data systems and processes. Because there's this greater degree of automation and autonomy, I suppose, within the model space, the process through which the models are built, validated, and deployed needs to be very, very structured. And often, as a model risk professional, you're called on to assess other factors within the process other than the models. You know, whereas when I started working in this field, I probably knew nothing about data other than, you know, you go and get the data from that database and then you plug it into your code. These days, kind of the data architecture, potentially radar or BCBS 239 considerations, all of that is now becoming topic or relevant to model risk professionals. Soft skills, for those who worked in model development or model validation, I kind of will know what I mean. And then continuous learning, because of the kind of exponential growth and complexity, the need to continuously learn, develop, train becomes overarching. So in summary, what I really wanted to say, I suppose, on this slide is that it's expensive and it requires continuous investment to do it properly. And it is difficult to justify an incremental improvement world. So an investment, but by that I mean almost the often in the banks stuff, you know, doesn't get done until there is a problem. So if you look at model risk management, and often there is, you know, and it's working, it's very difficult to convince the powers that be to invest more because of something that's coming down the line. So that incremental improvement is difficult. And then, yeah, it's slow to build capability but quick to destroy. I think we all know that. If it takes years for us to find the right people, to train them, to develop them, to give them the right kind of experience, because, I mean, doing model risk properly, it's not. It is also related to the company in which your experience has been acquired. And once the people leave, it's very, very difficult to rebuild that capability. And that we have seen that. Next slide. Okay. So then I mentioned earlier about the governance piece and why it's important. And I think, you know, if you read about model risk, ChatGPT is fantastic. Sorry, I'm going to say that again. You can go on there and you can tell me all about model risk. It'll bring up lots of stuff. I think the importance, again, for me is a structured approach to management of model risk and consistency. Model life cycle gives us that. So, in essence, at every step of the life cycle, the work that you do or the testing, depending on whether it's, for example, an AI or a traditional statistical model, may be very, very different. But the process and the steps and the purpose of each step is consistent and the same. So, yeah, I mean, quickly is kind of maybe 2 minutes to speak about this. So first of all, problem definition is absolutely critical. I think there's that old saying that when the only tool you've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. A lot of the times, you know, the guys just want to build a model, because that's how you solve a problem, by building another model. I think to define the problem clearly, so what are you trying to fix, or what are you trying to enable to do that you can't do now, that will then link to the piece of to the work that you're actually going to be doing, which is obvious, but that doesn't happen in practice. And I mean, again, AI and machine learning is a case in point, because we'll talk about, you know, thin file scorecards, but where even before considering kind of the optimality of the approach or what the desired outcome is, the decision was made to go and invest in this massive exercise of building something exceptionally complex. So from problem definition, you can proceed to data collection, information collection. I think data is obvious, information a bit less so, but I think it's linked to, for example, expert knowledge or you know, not, as I mentioned earlier, knowledge about strategy or processes that have changed over time. So when you proceed to building models, you need to have the context as well, not just the data. Then methodology selection, performance testing, model fitting, model documentation, kind of self-explanatory to actuaries. I think the one I would like to possibly highlight is the performance testing piece and the importance of doing out-of-sample or out-of-time performance testing. To avoid overfitting. I'm sure that's in a banking book. Model validation has always been kind of, and validation is about, I think, assurance and challenge. Originally, and probably up to now, it's always been flagged as a principal kind of control within the model risk management cycle. I think we're moving away from that now. I think validation is still very, very important when we're looking at a new model. But on an ongoing basis, it becomes, you know, impractical in the context of how complex the models are and how quickly they're refreshed. So model approval then follows. The model approval will be by probably a multidisciplinary panel, not just by one person. And there may be technical input at that stage with technical committee approval. You've got model deployment, implementation testing, and operationalization. Okay, I wrote that, but I think something that's missed quite often is that you're actually trying to deploy a model into a system and you want it to work seamlessly. So when you build a model, that's not the end of your job, I suppose. And as you build the model, you need to consider that as well. So when, as you build the model, you need to consider at the very least whether that model is implementable or usable in practice. Data collection, information collection. So once the model is running, you will want to have preferably an automated way of collecting data, collecting information, so that you could assess whether the model is performing, how well it is performing. Then you move into performance monitoring, business monitoring, which is really important. I think the performance monitoring aspect is the quantitative, the business monitoring, I think some people refer to being fit for purpose, is qualitative. And certainly something like credit models, and particularly wholesale credit models, that is significantly more important than quantitative performance monitoring. And then challenger model. I think something that new technology gives us now is that ability to Once the model is implemented, hopefully the infrastructure, the system into which it is implemented, facilitates data collection and data recording. And because you've got clean data available, you should be easily, in the current technological environment, be able to build challenger models as part of your monitoring. And of course, if you can build a better model than what you have, then you've got to consider whether there's more work to be done to improve it. Then model updates from there. If you decide to do a model update, that goes back into the whole cycle. And then the other thing, the important thing, is the model needs to be recertified on an annual basis or biannual or whatever you as a company feel is sufficient. It needs to be recertified for use. So it's not a recertification of model quality or it's not about how well the model predicts. It's a recertification that the organization is still comfortable to use the model for the particular purpose. And then, of course, you've got model decommission. And hopefully you do that well, because often decommission is not stopping to use the model. Decommissioning is to removing the model from your systems so that it cannot be used. I think sometimes we see gaps in that space as well. I think, do I have another slide? I don't remember. Can I see? No, that's it. Yeah. Not the particularly exciting conversation, but hopefully you've picked up something different and not something that you read in your study notes around the risk. Questions?
The recertification, does it come before decommissioning, or is that in those arrows? I would have assumed that they would have been independent, like you wouldn't recertify something.
I suppose you'd need to make a decision to decommission.
Okay, so the certification is part of the decommission process, or?
What I meant there is recertification for continued use. You can't unilaterally decommission as well, but yeah. So decommissioning, no, it's not part of the recertification.
Okay.
Thanks for the presentation. I think this is on the topic of AI and machine learning, but more to when things fail. So I think when you have models with explainable relationships and those break down, you can more stably and safely decommission and quickly, if you need to, move to another model. The concern with AI and ML is if I'm then asked by management, why did this model fail and what went wrong, what relationships no longer hold, my fears I'll be caught scratching my head. So that's, in your experience, I mean, how's that played out in the AI ML space when models do fail and the reason for their failure can't be explained well by the people who built them, forgetting however well the algorithms perform?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think there's this whole field of kind of what they call ML ops, machine learning operations, that has to do with the deployment and monitoring models. But yeah, ultimately, I suppose it depends on the AI or ML model or a machine learning model, right? There are machine learning models out there that are discrete. So using a really complex algorithm on a lot of data to build a model that will remain constant for a period of time and then you're going to replace it. So that would require different type of monitoring and a different contingencies than a model that self-updates on a continuous basis. If the model self-updates on a continuous basis, you have to have a predetermined capability to monitor it in real time. You have to have predetermined thresholds to flag or triggers to stop the model and potentially when it stops working, whatever that means. And then, of course, you've got to have some kind of a fallback contingency when you do stop the model.
I'm new to banking, so this is going to be a really stupid question. The unknown you model in all of these models is fundamentally the same idea. Will the The unknown you model is, will the customer pay back the money? And all the models then have layers upon layers of building on that one unknown. Is it more risky to have a proliferation of models managed by different teams, or let's call it a single model with trees that would then run the bank, if that makes sense?
Do you mean like for the same customer?
For the same line of business, I suppose. As you go through the different buckets in the bank that you're modeling, you bring in a lot of risk to me when you have all these different teams building different models, ostensibly predicting the same concept. That's just a philosophical question.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably, I think it's particularly relevant to retail. I mean, in wholesale, you would typically try and rate a client as a whole, with some exceptions, like specialized lending, not necessarily, sorry, but there are some exceptions where you would look at the exposure in isolation. But in retail, typically, because you're dealing with monoline businesses, and because of historical, the way the banks developed historically, or the infrastructure, or the non-modernizing necessarily, the monoline businesses don't necessarily talk to each other in real time. So you battle to have a customer view in real time. You might be able to later on in the data, and the database is kind of collated using some form of identifier. But in practice, to rate a customer in retail is quite difficult. And that's why you would very often get a different outcome. So across different, so if a person applies for a credit card or for a home loan, you might get a different score or a different probability. I think what you kind of, where what helps manage it in a way is bureaus, and that's why probably why we still use bureau scores so extensively, because it gives you the overall customer risk in this view. And yeah, in a way, and I've never seen it done really well, is consistency of model methodology or kind of standardization of model methodology. But we do try and drive it as much as possible through kind of the central, my central team. But ultimately, yes, it's quite a difficult, in retail, it's quite difficult to make sure you kind of to get that consistent view of the client.
Hi. My question relates to the governance and specifically almost around the administration of the model inventory, I suppose. You showed on one of your earlier slides that there is a proliferation of models across all areas. How do you ensure that you capture all of the models that are currently in use, and how do you monitor that administratively and make sure that they're all kind of up to date and so on? Because some, and I suppose it also goes down to your definition of a model, not all of them are implemented in a system. Some are spreadsheets used on various people's desks. Are those included in your inventory?
Yeah.
To what extent do you manage that risk?
So the way we look at it, or the way we look at the definition of the model, and I suppose it's not a secret, is if there is an element of uncertainty in it. So something that's a spreadsheet where the calculation is being done the only way it can be done, for example, like a prescriptive regulatory calculation, is not a model. It's got operational risk and kind of use risks associated with it, but there isn't that inherent model uncertainty or model quality consideration. So that's just to kind of differentiate. I think we're moving, and that's natural because of the risk-based thing I kind of said earlier. We're moving towards a consistent governance process. But consistent model life cycle, and that's captured in our model repository. So as every control is executed, and I guess recorded for audio purposes and so on and so forth. And what we'd like to do is absolutely, we'd like to capture all the models in the repository. However, we want to have flexibility not to execute certain stages of the process in certain conditions. And again, that's tied to the whole risk-based conversation. So if there is, if the risk of not executing a particular control is acceptable, then you know we will not do it. Just in terms of how do we know that everything is in the repository, we don't. It's kind of like the same as radar. You know, you hope you've got everything, but you know, probably not. But it's easy if you're dealing with kind of so what I mean my team does is they do go through sort of regular process of engaging the business unit, engaging the risk teams within the business unit on whether there's any new models. So like with machine learning and AI, there's been a lot of discontinuity in terms of it being done in a structured manner. So many teams within the organization kind of work on it or built it or deployed it. And the different types of AI models, right? You've got bots versus which is an efficiency play versus potentially credit forecasting model. So yeah, we went through an exercise now to actually bring all of that into governance. Again, we try and bring it into governance and into the repository even before we've decided what kind of governance needs to be executed. Because to have sight of that whole ecosystem is probably the most important thing.
So thank you for your presentation. The question I have is, at the moment, banks are pretty good at lending money, doing credit. And for most banks, they get back their capital plus the interest in full and on time. And you could pluck a number from the ether and call it, let's say, 94% confidence in terms of the lending that they do based on the fact that you don't want to write off your capital. So there's a certain level that you've got to get to. With these models, how are you going to measure their value add to the organization? Do you do that against the confidence interval, or do you do it against the broadening of the demographic of lending?
Sorry, are we talking a specific model type? Sorry,
no, just in general, how do you justify the models against the historic performance of banks in terms of their lending?
Yeah, no, look, absolutely, it's a difficult one. And that's kind of why I said before, it's often it is almost like a grudge purchase until the regulator, you know, if the regulator doesn't flip out, it's all cool. And then you get the letter from the PA and suddenly it's like, no, we'll throw money at it, just make it go away. So, and I've seen that across all the banks. My personal view, there are limited incremental benefits within that capital model space. So once you've got them more or less accurate, and by that I might be 95, 92% accurate, to try and improve it and optimize it might be counterintuitive. And you'd rather work on some form of standardization that reduces the cost of governance and the complexity and all that type of stuff. Impairment models kind of feel the same about it. Because in a way, you're going to lose what you're going to lose on the book that you wrote. It's just how it accrues year on year through your income statement. So again, there is, to my mind, a threshold where it's good enough. I think application scorecards, for example, would probably be a different ballgame. There, whatever incremental lift you can get is possibly worth it. but the complexity there is, where does that trade-off between kind of performance and complexity, where's that sweet spot? So even in machine learning, you know, I did a training, and I'm not an expert in doing machine learning, but kind of often something as simple as a decision tree will give you a close outcome to a much more complex algorithm. So, you know, when is it good enough, and when do you want to push it, kind of the envelope, push the boundary? I think you can deal with that through the challenger model kind of step, I suppose, particularly if you've got an incumbent model, because you can say, look, build a challenger model which are of the same complexity but perform better, or build challenger models that perform kind of in a similar manner but are much simpler. And I suppose that's how we would look at it. But it is very, very difficult to convince kind of a large scale investment into the model space, into the development space even, and certainly into the model risk management space. So it's not an easy conversation.
All right, I would like to close. Because I think we are in Cuba by level.
Yeah.
I think there are some things. Maybe ask, then you'll be nice.
Okay.
And Simon.
Okay. In model risk management as a practice, so given that model risk manifests in the use of models, so it will manifest in credit risk, market risk, operational risk, etc. What type of modeling do you see is lacking in model risk management as a practice? So. Just as an example, in this model lifecycle, you've got many activities. All of this contributes to good model risk management practice. Where do you see, MRM models lacking? The use of models to basically do your job.
Yeah. It's not a 3-minute
answer. I know, that's why I
didn't want to. That's why I didn't kind of say, I had a slide which said what is the future and sort of like technological advances, but that's so abstract. That's why I kind of said challenger models. So given what we have in terms of current capability, that's easily deployable. Automation of monitoring or automation of performance assessment is easily deployable if you've got the proper data system infrastructure, because one is to automate or productionalize something if the upstream processes are not consistent, it's going to get the consistency. I think it will depend on kind of this whole data quality, data architecture, data volume conversation. So, and you know, like in my experience, the banks, they collect data, but they collect limited data. So you're not talking about like Google, which whose business is data, right? The more data they've got, and they're completely data hungry. Banks, not necessarily that way. So there'll always be limitations. But yeah, I think we are going to get to. I think the difficulty is that real-time performance assessment, challenger models. And that's probably like the holy grail. We want to get to the point where in parallel, immediately we can say if the model needs to be awake. So we don't need to do a model validation, for example, because that step is effectively performed. And the technology to build it in that way is available. The technology to automate it is available. The difficulty is with productionalizing the upstream processes, in particular kind of data availability, data quality, data avoidance. So once we deal with that, then that will be easy.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. What we can do is those who want to stay with Simon in this room, thank you very much. My job
is a very easy one. It's a straightforward one. I came here and we opened the session in the morning. That's the job of a chairman. Just come and waffle a bit. You get away. You leave those who know we have knowledge to speak the whole day.